This podcast is part of the Acast Creator Network.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. United Healthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about United Healthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello and welcome to The Stand with Eamon Dunphy. Now, we are, according to the Polish Prime Minister Donald Tusk, living in a pre-war era. It is, we know, the world a dangerous place with Putin's invasion of Ukraine, with the conflict between Israel and the Palestinians, notably the Hamas terrorists who committed a genocidal attack on Israel on October 7th, and Israel has responded with what many people, including our own government, believe to be a genocidal attack on Palestine, which has seen casualties of a really shocking number. There is also, of course, the possibility that the Middle East conflict will become larger. The fear, that is, because so important that region for the production of oil, and indeed for the supply lines through the Suez Canal and elsewhere. Also in the United States of America, there has been massive spending. The economy is good, but is it sustainable? And to discuss the dangers of all of this economically, we're joined now by Chris Johns. Chris, former chief economist of the Bank of Ireland, and now a respected commentator. Chris, thank you very much for joining us. We are, I'm sure you'd agree, living in dangerous times. Yesterday, Rishi Sunak and his defence minister announced a budget that they described as wartime budget for increased defence spending. This is a government that doesn't have much money. And today, Sunak is meeting Olaf Scholz, the German chancellor. Germans have also dramatically upped their spending on defence. But it's in the Middle East, is it not, that we have memories of the war in 1967, which was the Six-Day War, and the war in 1973, which I think was the one that pushed oil prices up so high that there was an international economic crisis. Are we in danger from all of those things economically?
Yes, we are, Eamon. I firmly think that these are possibly the most extraordinary and risky times that I can remember for a very long time. And, you know, I was alive during the Cuban Missile Crisis. So, yes. So I go back a long way. As you say, the Middle East has occasionally thrown up severe global economic consequences. And the most obvious one being 1973. There's also a big oil price spike in 1979. So the 70s are what people like me and you remember. More often than not, though, that the tensions in the Middle East don't lead to these big oil price spikes. Those were exceptions rather than the rule. And so it has proven this time so far. The oil price hardly reacted at all to Israel's response to Iran's attacks, or Iran's response to Israel's attacks, depending on where you start the particular military merry-go-round of late. But in terms of the geopolitical situation, there are plenty of historians who are joining dots. And I'm not a historian, so I don't know whether they're right to do this or not. But they're saying that the soundbite is it's beginning to look a lot like the 1930s, where historians then play the game of the 1930s of tracing all the different hotspots, conflicts that took place prior to the start of the Second World War. China's war with Japan, Russia's war with Japan, various hotspots eventually leading via the Spanish Civil War, all those different conflicts eventually culminated in 1939 to 1945. And people, historians like Hal Brands of Princeton, Institute for International Strategic Studies, is saying explicitly that there are similar dots to be joined now. Max Hastings, who we've spoken about in many different contexts to do with Boris Johnson and Brexit mostly, an eminent military historian in his own right, has said something similar. Historians who perhaps we wouldn't normally pay too much attention to, like Niall Ferguson, are saying explicitly that we are running into the risks of World War III. So there's plenty of people about who are saying that we are running these geopolitical risks. Now, in terms of the economic consequences, the Middle East, the one thing to look at from what's going on there is the oil price. That is the single most important barometer of global risk as assessed by financial markets, by the world's smartest, savviest investors, if you like.
Yes.
And they're signaling that there isn't that much to worry about, because they are assessing that the chances of a full-blown war between Israel and Iran, and frankly, therefore, Israel-America and Iran, are still quite low, particularly in terms of that awful phrase, the calibrated responses of both sides to the recent flare-ups.
Yes.
And the oil price is stuck today at around $88 a barrel, which is on the high side of where it's been over the last year. But it's, as we say in the trade, within the range, and it hasn't done anything dramatic. So that's to be welcomed. But of course, war has consequences beyond simple oil prices and how they link into things like inflation and growth and interest rates and all those other things. We also have to think of the economic consequences of the Ukraine war, which we've all lived through to an extent at least. And the most obvious economic consequence of that war has been the energy price shock that we experienced during its first year. That's abated, of course, which is most welcome. So right now, financial markets are saying that those historians who are joining those dots are wrong. And if you look at stock markets around the world, you'll see that they're either at or close to all-time highs, for example. And that's another great barometer of risk. Markets get these things wrong, of course. Most famously, they got it wrong going into the First World War. They were doing very well right up until the guns of that war started firing. But to the extent that we can take messages from financial markets about these risks that historians are saying, financial markets are saying that the risks to the world economy are actually not too high at the moment. I'm not so sure. I suspect I'm a little bit more cautious than that and therefore a bit more worried.
And it does mean that military spending and defense spending has to move on to, as we saw in Britain yesterday, a wartime footing. Does that mean, Chris, that it has to take from everyday things like health, like welfare and other? We know Britain is just one example, but we know the British economy is not in great shape after Liz Truss and Kwasi Kwarteng and their 49 days in power. Nevertheless, Britain has always stepped up to the plate, even Boris Johnson in Ukraine. And now Sunak is putting Britain economically on a wartime footing. What should we read into that economically?
Well, I think a useful place to start is the end of the Cold War. And that gave rise economically to something called the peace dividend.
Yes.
And what that meant was that countries' military spending, where I'm sitting at the moment in the UK, it collapsed and has been falling really ever since the Berlin Wall came down, right up until yesterday when Sunak announced that it was going to increase. It has been falling as a percentage of GDP ever since the late 1980s, early 1990s. Globally, military spending has been increasing a lot in recent years. There are various ways of counting this. The Stockholm Institute for Military Studies reckons the total global military expenditure reached $2.4 trillion last year, which was an increase of 6.8% in real terms. It's been going up really over the last 2 or 3 years, and it's being led by the three countries that you would expect it to be led by: the United States, China, and Russia. And United States military spending this year is going to be just shy of $1 trillion. It's going to be $900 odd billion. These are all very, very big numbers. And I know these sorts of numbers make people's heads spin. But in context, the budget, the increase in aid announced for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan that received so much publicity this week was around $100 billion. And that compares to an overall budget of 10 times that size. So in the context of what the US spends, it was a big deal, but not that big a deal. But the point about the peace dividend is that it's over. That's the substantive point to make. And what happened when military spending collapsed? So when the Berlin Wall came down, UK military spending, for instance, was about 5 to 6% of GDP, and it had been steadily decreasing since the end of the Second World War, but it was still very, very high. And then over the subsequent decades, it fell from that 5 to 6% to around 2% of GDP, or just over. And that freed up billions for other things. And, you know, Tony Blair was able to avail of that via increased spending on the NHS, on increased spending on the education system. And many countries were able to do similar things. Different countries did different things. Some spent it, some invested it, some saved it. But different countries all reaped the peace dividend, including China and Russia to an extent. That's over. So you rightly say that Germany has great plans for increasing military expenditure. So we learned yesterday, apparently does the UK, and I'll come on to the smoke and mirrors involved in those claims in a moment. But the substantive point is that we are going to have to spend, if we listen to the politicians anyway, a lot more money on defense. If you are joining those dots in the way that I spoke about earlier on, you have to get ready. You have to, in a way, preemptively spend, because as Churchill said, if you start spending once the threat is actually there, then it's too late. So that we're getting lots of Churchillian quotes from around the place this morning, not least from Sunak himself. And that's the problem that the UK in particular faces, is that in announcing these big increases in money, unlike the Germans, the UK doesn't have any money. And a lot of the announced increase in military spending, the figure of 75 billion was quoted yesterday. It was dishonest, Eamon, because if you actually delve into the numbers, and this is where people's heads spin, eyes glaze over, so I won't go into it in any great detail, it was more apparent than real. There was an awful lot of mucking about with statistics, an awful lot of mucking about with defense accounting definitions and all that inflation adjustment stuff that we economists do. And it wasn't a big deal. It really wasn't. And the reason for that is that Sunak knows, because for all of his faults, he can count. He knows that the UK doesn't have the money for increasing spending. And so they waffled on, for example, about reducing the size of the civil service in order to fund the increase in military spending. The civil service just isn't big enough. If you got rid of it altogether, it wouldn't be big enough to fund this increase in spending. So we don't know where the money is going to come from. The British government's spending plans in the round, in total, for the next few years to the end of the decade, are not credible anyway. By adding in extra spending, they just become more incredible. So we're in a real bind here. Germany isn't. But even there, talk is cheap, because at the start of the Ukraine war, Chancellor Scholz, you remember, talked about increasing military spending massively in Germany, and promised, I think, 100 billion euros extra spending in rapid order. And talk is cheap, Eamon, because he hasn't delivered.
Yes.
I think it's right to say that these increases in spending make an awful lot of sense militarily, given the threats, given all those dots that I spoke about earlier on that people are joining. But where the money is coming from remains to be seen. And if they do find the money, it's going to mean less welfare spending, less education spending, and all the rest of it. I mean, you're in a great position there, because we're talking about UK going up to 2.5 to maybe towards 3% of GDP. The US spends around 3.5% of GDP. That's that $900 billion. The US is the world's biggest military spender. In Ireland, you spend about 0.3% on defense. And I don't think there are any big dramatic increases in spending planned there. So the consequences
for you... That's a kind of free ride. Sorry, Chris, I didn't mean to interrupt you. That's a kind of free ride. Are we entitled to that as members of the European Union? Because we pride ourselves on our neutrality, or at least some people do, but it's a bit rich if everyone else is spending to protect Europe, particularly in the event of Donald Trump presidency and isolationism growing in the United States, where we're paying just 0.3% and everyone else is paying 2.5%.
Yeah, well, the 2.5% that Sunak wants to get to is... it's not yet a formal NATO commitment, but all members of NATO are supposed to spend 2% of GDP on defense. And that's the beef that Donald Trump has with NATO. And he's actually, I mean, don't shoot me for saying this, please.
No, I think he's right.
He's right. And there was a famous US president that made very Trump-like speeches a little while ago about Europe's failure to spend on its own defense. And his name was John F. Kennedy. And you can go back to some of the things he said that sound very like what Donald Trump has been saying recently. So, yes, the good news from that perspective, at least, is that a lot of NATO members have increased their spending to 2%. In the lead is Poland. And I think there are very obvious reasons. The closer you get to where the next European war is likely to start, if God forbid it does, is on that eastern border and where Poland sits. And so its military spending has been ramping up very rapidly for the last few years. But what Sunak and I think Scholz is trying to do is trying to badger Ukraine into spending, get that 2% floor up to 2.5%, which is a lot of money. 0.5% of GDP for the whole of NATO is a lot of money, is a lot of military spending. You can't do it all at once. There's a logistical point that you just simply don't have the capacity to simply say, okay, we're going to spend this much more on tanks, bombs, and guns. All of the factories need to be retooled and rebuilt and all of those things, because all of these things have been mothballed or just, you know, just gone. That's the peace dividend that I spoke about earlier on. Is Ireland sheltering under NATO's umbrella? Well, I know how political this is and how emotive it is, but the simple fact is that you do. And
yeah, I agree with you. I mean, but it is, we haven't had a serious debate about our neutrality, but it seems to me that it's inevitable if everybody else is doing it. It's incumbent on us.
Well, you're not a member of NATO, so you don't have to do this.
No, but we are a member of the European Union. And in the European Union, it's in the context of the European Union that this issue has to be settled as well. Would you not agree, Chris, that, you know, it's not individual nations. It is an issue now for Europe.
It is, because if you join those dots in the way that some of those historians are doing, there's another European war coming.
Yes.
That's the doomsday scenario, which we all hope and pray is an absolute worst case. What we're trying to do is hope for the best and prepare for the worst. And the worst possible outcome is another European war. But Ireland has to think what its position would be if there is a serious chance of another European war coming.
Yes.
And it needs an answer to that question. And if the answer is, well, we don't think there is another European war coming, so we don't need to do anything about it, that's fine. You're entitled to make that answer. But I do think the question needs to be asked, and the debate had in a sober, unemotional way, because I am aware, having lived in Ireland for 30 years, how emotional the neutrality debate
actually is.
Yeah. And the emotion needs to be stripped from this. And everybody in Ireland needs to ask themselves, serious people think that there is a chance of another European war coming. What is Ireland's position?
Yes, and the answer should be, what can we do?
Yeah, well, the obvious answer is you need.
I mean, what can we do to contribute?
Well, it's a bit like
Second World War.
Yeah, what can you do to contribute to reducing global warming? Absolutely nothing in terms of if you reduced all your greenhouse gases to nothing, you would contribute virtually nothing to ending global warming because of you're just too small. And so, so it is with military. If you put your military spending up to 2.5-3% of GDP, you would not make a material contribution to Europe's defense. It's whether or not you think you have moral, ethical, or philosophical reasons for doing it in the way that you do with global warming. You quite rightly say, well, it doesn't matter that we are immaterial in terms of global warming. What matters is being seen to do what we can. And I think similar arguments apply to military spending.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
One size fits all seems like a good idea for clothes until you try them on. Same goes for healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. Learn more at uh1.com.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Let me ask you about the U.S. economy, Chris, which is enjoying a remarkable boom in which spending is extraordinary and their national debt is also extraordinary. Donald Trump and Joe Biden, between them, post the pandemic, added about $10 trillion to their spending. Is the American, there is some debate about whether the American economy is headed for a hard landing, a soft landing, or indeed, the latest piece I've read, no landing. In other words, everything's going to be cool. Can they absorb that amount of stimulus, really, they're putting into the economy? Is it survivable? Have you looked at it?
Yes.
And what's your view of it, Chris? It's
something that exercises all economists that look at the US, because they've got full employment. In the bizarre way that economists measure full employment, they've actually got more than full employment. They've got more jobs than workers. And one of the reasons why they have still a small inflation problem is because the labor market is so tight and generating some wage and other types of inflation. And when economists are taught from short trousers that when you are running an economy at full employment, a very good rule of thumb for your budgetary fiscal policy is for it to be in balance. And they are a long way from that. They're budget deficit this year is likely to be around 6 to 7% of GDP. That's a direct consequence of those trillions that you mentioned earlier on that Donald Trump began and Joe Biden continued. And there's no doubt that that's something that is going to cause a problem at some point. It has to be said, it hasn't really caused a problem yet. A lot of people thought it would do, but it's a bit of a mystery as to why they're able to borrow quite so much money on top of what they've already borrowed in the past at a time really when they shouldn't be borrowing. And you might remember we've talked during the great financial crisis about Ireland and the bondholders. The bondholders are always the arbiters of this. And at the moment, the American government costs of all that borrowing are not too high. They're not too bad at all. They've gone up. There's no doubt about that. And America is facing a huge interest bill on its debt. That's where the rubber hits the road here, is that in future years, where is it going to find the money to pay off the interest on this debt, let alone ever pay it back? They'll never pay it back. Government debt is one of those really weird things that never gets paid back. It's the interest costs that matter. And there, I said that the barometer for the Middle Eastern risks is the oil price. The barometer for risks over the U.S. economy is the cost of government debt, the bond yield, if you like, the long-term, yes. the cost of long-term debt. And that's reasonably well behaved at the moment. It's been edging up lately, which is a bit of a concern, because every time it goes up, it raises the future cost of all those interest payments. And that's going to be the real problem, the sheer amount of dollars, the potentially trillions of dollars that they're going to need to find in future years to just pay the interest on this debt. And there are plenty of economists who think that there is going to be a real problem coming, and that some future president, be it Biden, Trump, or whoever, is going to have to engage in some serious fiscal consolidation to get this budget deficit down. Because if you're running a budget deficit at 6 to 7% of GDP at the time of full employment, you're either going to have to put taxes up and or cut government spending a lot to get it back to something like more sustainable levels. And frankly, that budget deficit needs to be half what it is before we get comfortable. So there's lots of potential problems out there. They're not there yet, but they certainly are storing up problems going forward. If, for example, they had the hard landing that you mentioned earlier on,
yes.
and the economy went into recession, because if we'd had this conversation a year, 18 months ago, I'd have told you that the conventional wisdom amongst economists is that the higher interest rates that America and indeed everybody else was experiencing because of the energy crisis and what their own central bank was doing with their interest rates would drive the economy into recession. So another mystery is why the US economy has not really reacted at all to a massive increase in interest rates from zero to over 5%. Now, if finally, like a bit like Roadrunner, the US economy does feel the effects of these higher interest rates and goes into recession, the borrowing of the US government will increase even further. And that would, I think, be a real, real problem for the US economy. But right now, the U.S. economy seems to be going great guns. So it's very easy. I think it's a little lazy to say that the only reason why the U.S. economy is doing well is because of Trump and Biden fiscal stimulus. It's definitely a factor, but you've got to think more deeply than that. We live in an age where we don't think deeply about very much, at least not here in the UK. And you've got to remember that the US has the world's best companies. It has the Apples and Microsofts of this world. And they're part of the story about why the US Yes. economy is doing so well. Ironically, another reason why the US economy is doing well is that the consumer has held up. Now, the consumer for most Western economies is about 2/3 of GDP. So it's the most important part. And the mystery of why the US economy hasn't had that hard landing is why consumer spending, the ordinary person in the street, has continued shopping. And there are lots of reasons for that. Pandemic assistance payments were a huge help in that regard. But the irony of this great immigration debate in the United States that Trump and Biden get stuck into all the time is that immigration has supplied an awful lot Yes. of the people needed for the jobs. Because remember, I said that there are more jobs than workers in the United States. Immigrants are filling that gap and are therefore earning the money that then contributes to the consumer spending. So there's lots going on. There's lots of moving parts. And so the story is complicated. It's not just about fiscal stimulus, but the US economy so far has defied gravity, and it's defied all the consensus forecasts of a year, 2 years ago, that the interest rates would produce a recession, so far at least.
You sound like our regulator in the around 2007.
Well, I hope I'm a wee bit more cautious than that.
No, I'm only joking. I mean, just let me ask you a final question, Chris. Our economy is sensibly doing really well, and we keep producing sort of surpluses. We all know that a lot of this is linked to U.S. multinationals who are here in pharmaceuticals or tech. Is there a threat to us, given how much we earn in taxes from U.S. companies, mostly? Does the fate of our economy, is it linked to the U.S. economy and the threats that you, or the dangers that you've outlined?
Yes, yes, and yes. are the three very simple answers to those,
and,
to the,
and
to those
how
questions.
How serious is it?
Well, you're far too dependent from a government revenue point of view on not just the U.S. multinational sector and other multinationals operating in Ireland. You're far too dependent on, frankly, two or three multinationals. We could name them. And you know, a change in accounting practices or a change in US tax law, what one company decides to do with respect to where its headquarters is could yes. dramatically affect your government revenues. There's also all the employment and all the things that flow from jobs, spending, yes. investment, and economic consequences of all that stuff. It's far too narrowly based. But that's the same point that has been made, frankly, for years. And we keep on making it. And it just keeps on going, is one simple observation to make. But usually what's unsustainable eventually proves to be so.
Yes.
And one day, and God knows when it's going to be, you will run into trouble because the tailwinds of this very high dependency on the multinational sector will turn into headwinds because something will come along. As I say, it'll either be international tax law, it'll be the individual decisions taken by these two or three companies in their headquarters to do something different.
Yes.
It might be that some technological innovation renders one of these companies' products no longer profitable. Something like that will come along. And then you will regret not having spent a lot more money and time and effort and energy in developing the domestic Irish yes. economy. Because when you have a lopsided economy, you need to think deeply about what that actually means and look at the bits of the economy that aren't doing quite so well. And that's the domestic economy. And one of the things that your SME sector, small and medium-sized enterprises, what that acronym means, has been bleating about for years is just the headwinds that they face from a taxation, from a cost, from a regulatory point of view. Now, companies always bleat, and you always have to aim off from what they're saying and seasonally adjust the fact that they always want something. Everybody always wants something more, don't they? We're like children in that regard. But there is substance behind their complaints. And Ireland could and should be doing much, much more to encourage its domestic sector, because it's right to do for its own sake. But one day you're going to need it much more than you need it today. And you're going to be saying, why didn't we encourage the domestic sector much more? Because the international sector isn't what it was. We wish we had a much stronger domestic economy. And that's the thing I would urge any Irish policymaker to do, to think deeply and seriously about how you encourage domestic industries, particularly small and medium-sized enterprises.
Okay, Chris, that's a sober note to end on, but we're very grateful to you for that. Chris Johns, former economist, chief economist with the Bank of Ireland. We're grateful to Chris, to all of you for listening. That's all we have time for now. We'll talk to you soon.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hold up. What was that? Boring. No flavor. That was as bad as those leftovers you ate all week. Keke Palmer here. And it's time to say hello to something fresh and guilt-free. HelloFresh. Jazz up dinner with pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Now that's music to my mouth. HelloFresh. Let's get this dinner party started. Discover all the delicious possibilities at HelloFresh.com.